After thinking I have put up our cell phone, I think we should start. We are hoping that the members of the committee numbers will increase at least by 3. We've received apologies from Mr. Self and Advocate Max, and from Palisha and Mr. Novo. Anybody else? No, Mr. Panamerva is non-existent in this committee. All right, so there should be at least 3 more members of the committee that will join us, and hopefully Self and Max, if they are around, but they did indicate that they wouldn't be around for the afternoon session. We want to, first of all, our agenda is to get a briefing from civil society, or at least 2 or 3 components of civil society, I'm led to believe, were party to the document. And it's born from the fact that in our various interactions, we've asked them to move away from theory or just slogans or just giving us ideas to put something more practical that we could look at the committee, and if we are convinced that it is helpful, that it becomes another tool that the committee can use when we consider the budget, the strat plan, the budget review in October, the amendments to the budgets that happen midway through the financial year, and also just to assist the department in being able to deliver on its promises of the white paper and the various legislation that apply to correctional services specifically and to the criminal justice cluster generally. So that's really what it is about. We will then get a presentation from the IFS, allow them to go through their presentation, and then for us to interrogate it and to have a discussion around what they propose in their presentations. It really is just to sharpen the committee. Glad that the department is here as well. You'll get a sense of what civil society is saying and maybe get a sense of what the committee thinks of civil society's contribution so that you can go and report that to your principals, especially bearing in mind that our next 2 meetings, the first one is that we're going to engage with you as the department around your performance for the last quarter, and the second engagement in that the very next week would be a state of the department by the minister. It will be a free-for-all. Those are the 2 engagements that we have. One is specifically around the department's performances. Then second one is the minister coming to tell us what's happening in her department, and all these things would then be able to assist us in asking questions or interrogating both the department and the minister's input. So you'd be able to take something here as part of your preparations for the 1st and the 8th of May. 1st and 8th of May, June, I beg your pardon, yeah. So just for both ISS and all our visitors, our next 2 engagements are really about the state of the department, from the minister directly and also from the senior managers directly. That's where we are, or that's where we are. That's the intention of today's interaction. Welcome to Ms. Gold and her team and everybody else that has joined us. You're welcome. We are scheduled to be here until about 1 o'clock, I think, or sooner if possible. If the department had scheduled a strategic meeting for afterwards, but we'll have a discussion around that with the other department, the committee, later on. So you have, I don't know how much time you need, Ms. Gold, but we will then open it up and have a robust discussion thereafter. I welcome it.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, members of the committee, representatives from the Department of Correctional Services, and colleagues. Thank you very much for this opportunity to be here today and to present to you a report that, as the Chairperson has mentioned, really flows from a request that arose last year during our submission to this committee on the DCS budget to say to us, challenge us really, to do more than just come and complain every year about the budget that is put before the committee and to come with some substance. Now, I hope that this report is the substance that you need. I think it certainly raises a number of questions about the way forward in relation to policy, and I hope we can have a robust discussion indeed. So really, this process was funded by the Open Society Foundation. It involved the Institute for Security Studies, that was the lead organization involved in the process of developing this report. But we worked very closely both with MICRO and with the Civil Society Prison Reform Initiative. And have, unfortunately, we are without a representative today from CSPRI or NICRO, who are not able to be here, although we are expecting a representative from NICRO, but both those organizations have been party to the development of this report, have commented on its content. So really, this is a joint initiative. In addition to which, we used the skills of an economist. We had a consultant working with us, somebody who had previously worked with Treasury, had experience in drafting budgets. Good morning. What we had hoped at the outset is to be able to come to this committee with a new budget. What became clear to us through this process is the kind of detailed information about costing that is required in order to arrive at a budget is not the kind of information that is readily available to civil society. But what we have done is we have provided in this report, which I believe is before you, an analysis of the department's budget in some detail. We've identified what it is that drives costs in the DCS. What we've also tried to do is an attempt to cost what providing rehabilitation programs on the scale envisaged by the white paper would be. So in other words, if we were to ask the DCS to roll out nationally rehabilitation programs that follow international best practice, what is that going to cost us? And can we do it within the existing budget? These are the questions we've looked at. What this report does is it demonstrates that within the current budget, and given the constraints in relation to facilities, the provision of rehabilitation programs of the sort I have described is not possible. Our conclusion is to call for an overhaul of policy regarding incarceration. The report really identifies two serious issues. It identifies the fact that policy shifts are required in order to improve our return on investment if that results from putting people in prison. We also recognize that those policy shifts cannot be made by the Department of Correctional Services alone. These are policy shifts that are going to be required and have implications throughout the criminal justice system. I will demonstrate that in this presentation. So fundamentally, we're arguing that a radical rethinking of the role that imprisonment or incarceration plays in our society needs to be undertaken. Before we go forward, I think it's very important for us to...
Just clarity. I'm sorry, Minister, for this again. You said earlier on that the current budget would not be able to allow the department to implement the white paper, and therefore we're looking at a policy shift to be able to do, or to get value for money. That's what you were saying.
To get value for money.
That's fine.
Yes.
All right.
I'll give a bit more substance as I go along. But I think it's also important to keep in perspective when we're talking about this. If we are saying that within the current budget the department can't implement the white paper, and we are giving an idea of what it might cost to do that, I think it's important for us up front to also say that we are not necessarily here to advocate for an increase in the department's budget. Because if we look at this slide, you will see that right now in this year we're going to spend 6.8 billion rand housing 160 offenders in prison. In the same year, we will spend 13.8 billion educating all learners in South Africa from grade R to grade 12. In other words, we are spending less money on basic education, which is servicing millions of learners, than we are on keeping 160 offenders in prison. That is the perspective that it's important to retain. And that is why we don't believe that increasing the amount of money we spend on incarceration is a good idea. Incarceration is expensive. That is what this figure tells us. And that means that it cannot be our first resort to dealing with people who break the rules of society. It also tells us that because it is so expensive, we have an obligation to get right the policy to ensure, one, that incarceration is used minimally and where it's absolutely necessary, and it is our responsibility to ensure that the department provides the best possible service at the lowest possible cost. What I'm going to do in this presentation is I'm going to outline some basic facts about spending levels in relation to the department's budget, then talk in some detail about what it is that drives costs in the Department of Correctional Services, and may I just say welcome to Vanessa from NICRA. I'm very glad that you could join us. We're then going to look at the impact of the white paper on the work of the department and give you our costing of rehabilitation, and finally come to some recommendations and policy choices. So if we have a look at just some of the basic facts, we know that last year the department's budget was 15.2 billion, which was a 37% increase from what it was in 2007-2008. It's going to rise again by just over 20% in the current year and going on until 2013-14. Which represents overall a 69% growth in the budget since 2007-8. Now, you might think that sounds like an enormous increase in the DCS budget, but I think we need to contextualize that by showing this figure, which is not very easy to see at a distance. It is in your documents on page 6, I believe. And what this graph shows you is that actually in the same period when the DCS's budget has increased by 69%, national budget has increased by 94%. The budget to provinces, the allocation to provinces has increased by 89%, and so on. In other words, if the DCS's budget had grown at the same rate as the police budget, right now the DCS budget would be 1.1 billion rand higher than it is. Well, if we take, but that's perhaps a little bit skewed, because if we take out the cost of the four PPP that were planned and removed from the budget, then it would only be 700 million rand larger if it had grown at the same rate as the police budget. And as a consequence of this fall in the percentage growth of the budget, what we're going to see over time is that the share that DCS gets of the national budget is going to fall from 2.1% in 2007-8 to 1.8% in 2013-14. Now, I'm not presenting this to say it's a bad thing. Perhaps it's a good thing. But it is something worth noting, particularly as we go on to think about the effectiveness of the criminal justice system as a whole. Now, there are many ways in which one can interpret the budget of the department. One way would be to undertake a functional breakdown of the budget by programs, and I think that this committee has seen this kind of breakdown quite often. And I don't think I need to tell you, go into too much detail about what the programs are. But what we know is that if we break it down by program, we see that just over a third of the budget is spent on security, 26% is spent on administration, 12% of the budget on facilities, 11% on care, 9% on corrections, and a mere 3% each on development and social reintegration. This has been an issue that we've brought to the committee's attention time and time again as civil society, that we've been concerned about the low allocation to development and social reintegration. But as we go through this analysis, perhaps it will become apparent why it's very difficult for the department to shift that, in fact, at this stage. This graphic that I have up now, and which also appears in your report on page 8, shows that, in fact, when we look at these program allocations, not much has changed over the last few years. The share of the budget that has been going to each of these programs is pretty consistent over time. Perhaps another way of looking at the budget, which is more useful than looking at it from the point of view of a program analysis, is to look at it by economic classification. And this is a point that has been raised by the Honourable Chair on a number of occasions. If we break down the budget by economic classification, what we see is that the department is spending about two-thirds of its budget on personnel costs. It's spending about a third, just under a third, on goods and services. And now that goods and services category is a category that includes leases, it includes payments on property, payments for food and medicine, outsourced services. So there's quite a lot going on in that category. 7% is spent on physical infrastructure, but this varies. I mean, I think one of the things that this committee is very conscious of is the fact that spending on physical infrastructure comes in big bulk amounts at a certain period, slows down again, comes again as a bulk amount. So that amount does vary across the years. The following graphic is a breakdown of showing what percentage of the budget is spent in these economic classifications. So as you can see, there was an increase in what we've seen in terms of staff payments, in other words, the compensation of employees, is a gradual growth from 2007-08 to 2010-11 and a somewhat leveling off, which has less to do with the fact with changes in staff remuneration than it does to do with numbers of staff. Now, another way in which the DCS budget is often analyzed is by talking about the cost per prisoner to the DCS. In other words, what is the daily cost to the Department of accommodating a prisoner? And the way that this calculation is usually done is by taking the total budget and dividing that budget by the number of people who move through facilities. It's really a very simple calculation. And on that basis, you might come to certain conclusions, like, for example, that we know that last year the average cost per prisoner per day was 259 Rand. We might compare that to the average cost in 2007-08, which was 26% lower than it is today. And we may then say, okay, well, this tells us something about the cost effectiveness of DCS's activity. But particularly because of the changes in expenditure on infrastructure, this kind of analysis is mistaken in our view. And it's not a useful analysis, and we would strongly suggest that we don't use that cost per prisoner per day as a way of assessing cost effectiveness of the DCS, simply because it's skewed by infrastructure. So then the question arises, what is it that actually does drive costs? What influences cost to the Department of Correctional Services? And there are three factors, in our view, that do this. The one is prisoner numbers. Now, quite obviously, the more prisoners you have, the higher the cost. The second is the range and the quality of services. Now, here we're talking about services, all services, not just rehabilitation services. This is accommodating prisoners, giving them health care. It's making sure that they are safe and secure. So if you were to change the range of services you were offering prisoners, or you were to improve the quality of those services, the cost is going to increase. So, for example, if we think about accommodation, it is more expensive to build 15 two-person cells than it is to build one 30-person cell. And it's cheaper to build one 15-person cell and stuff it with 30 people than it is to have a 30-person cell. So the fact is that these are things that vary over time. In addition to which, we have the cost of services is going to drive costs in the Department of Correctional Services. And this really relates because personnel within the Department of Correctional Services are those who are providing the services within prisons. Your cost of personnel is going to drive your cost of services, or it's going to influence or inform your cost of services. So what is it that drives prisoner numbers? Because prisoner numbers we've identified as one of the big issues in relation to cost. Well, there are four things, really. The one is the crime rate. Now, one could presume that the higher the crime rate, the more prisoners you might end up with in prison. That's not necessarily a very useful way of looking at it, but certainly crime rate is one of the things that might influence the number of prisoners. But more importantly, it's what happens when somebody is found to be a criminal and how they are processed through the criminal justice system. So if we have a fully effective criminal justice system, the courts are the police are doing their job to detect crime, the courts are doing their job to prosecute crime, and those criminals are ending up in prison, and those laws are being applied in terms of sentencing and so on, this is going to influence the number of prisons. Now, Parliament, to some extent, can have an influence over this. So Parliament can, for example, influence, to a large degree, the sentencing regime. And other role players, like the Department of Justice and others, might have an influence over this as well. The Department of Correctional Services' own influence over these variables that drives prisoner numbers and therefore cost is minimal. They do have some ability to influence that, but it really is not dramatic. So what this means is that while the number of prisoners is a key variable in driving costs in the department, it's not something the department can do much about. If we have a look then at what has happened to prisoner numbers over the last few years, we see that there was a dramatic increase in prisoner numbers between 1995 and 2003, but since 2003, prisoner numbers have actually remained stable. In fact, since 2006, the daily average prisoner population, and this includes remand detainees or awaiting trial detainees, has moved in a very narrow band, between 159,000 and 165,000. If you have a look here at this graphic, what you can see is that after 2005, when there was a big release of prisoners, you see in from 2006 to where we are now, there's really not an enormous change. So prisoner numbers have remained stable over the past 5 years. So why are they stable, one might ask, particularly given that the crime rate is high, and violent crime rates in particular have been identified as being high. Also, you might ask, why has it remained stable given that over the last few years, since 2003, we have increased the number of police members by 66,000. So we've got 66,000 more police officers on the beat, but the number of prisoners in our prisons remains constant. So either we've got fewer people moving through the criminal justice system, or they're receiving shorter sentences. That's the only conclusion you can draw from this. But we know that it's not true that people are receiving shorter sentences. If you look at this next graph, you will see that if you look at the black line in particular, that tells you what the average sentence length is. And you can see that since 2000, it's been on a steep increase in leveling off, but increasing again. So what we're seeing now is that in 1995, the average length of sentence for somebody in a VCS facility was 4.4 years. Now it's 7.3 years. So we have got people spending longer sentences, we have prisoners serving longer sentences than we did in the past. And this is a direct consequence of minimum sentencing legislation. So really what one can draw from this is that the DCS is fortunate that the rest of the criminal justice sector does not seem to be functioning optimally. And I'm going to give you a demonstration of why I believe we can say that. The 15-year review undertaken by the presidency, for example, found that the number of convictions in South African courts fell from 96,000 in 2006 to 75,000 in 2008. If you have a look at the next graph, it shows you the conviction rates, and there it's very clear to see that we've seen a decrease in the number of convictions for serious property crimes and for serious violent crimes over the last 3 years, between 2004 and 2006 at least. And we have reason to believe that this trend continued after 2006. We will be bringing out a report later in the year on the functioning of the National Prosecuting Authority, and I believe that you will see that this downward trend has continued. The same research found that the conviction rate for serious crimes committed in the 5 years between 2001 and 2006 varied. So basically what that table is showing you is that of those cases of murder that the police were reported to the police, 43% went to court and 20% resulted in conviction. It's much lower for things like car theft. Now, if I can just show you the following graph in terms of the SAPS's performance, because this is important. The Department of Correctional Services is the end of the criminal justice system. So the functioning of the other parts of the criminal justice system are very important to the department. Now, if you look here, this shows from 2003 to 2010, the SAPS's arrest trends. The blue lines is all arrests made by the police. The red line is arrests for crimes less serious than shoplifting. The green line is for priority crimes, everything more serious, shoplifting and everything more serious. And what this shows us is that the police are arresting more people for crimes less serious than shoplifting than they are for crimes of shoplifting and things more serious, which is deeply concerning. Also, if you have a look at the number of people who are sentenced to incarceration, you see that this figure has been falling over the past year. So all this adds up to the fact that we can say that the number of newly admitted prisoners to correctional facilities has dropped by 44% since 2004. The number of prisoners has stabilized, the turnover of prisoners has been reduced, and prisoners seem more time in prison than they did in the past. What this tells us, even more so than I mentioned it earlier, we have shown now that were the criminal justice system functioning optimally, DCS would be in serious crisis. The overcrowding levels would be much higher than they are right now. But it also has told us that prisoner numbers is not driving costs in the Department of Correctional Services. Sorry. I do apologize. So what is the other driver of costs in the Department of Correctional Services? And we know that that's personnel costs. Since we're spending 66% of the DCS budget on personnel, obviously it's a big cost driver. Now, the personnel costs are informed by two things: the number of people you employ and how much you pay them. Now, again, like other government departments, the Department of Correctional Services has very little control over the agreements that are reached in relation to the remuneration of civil servants. These are agreements reached in the Public Services Bargaining Council and Bargaining Chamber. And we've seen a rapid increase in the average remuneration of civil servants over the past few years. And this is something that affects all departments. It's not only affecting the Department of Correctional Services, but it is certainly a cost driver. One of the things that was hoped would mitigate against this was the introduction of the 7-day week. But I think that the jury is still out on whether the 7-day week is in fact resulting in a reduction of cost to the department and whether in fact it is practical and has resulted in savings. I think these are things that we're only going to be able to assess in a little bit of time. So we know that the Department of Correctional Services budget is in fact under pressure. And how do we know that? Well, we know that for one, the biggest indicator that the department's budget is under pressure is that since 2007, posts have been frozen in the Department of Correctional Services. And we've seen a decline, a small decline, but a decline nonetheless in the number of these people employed by the department. We've also seen the department commit itself to a range of cost-cutting measures. Now, these include saying, for example, that we're going to spend less on fleet services. We're not going to make use to the same extent of external IT consultants. We're not going to spend so much on advertising or on expensive hotels. Now, arguably, the DCS should have been doing these things anyway. But the fact of the matter is it's also doing them because its budget is under pressure. Now, we know that its budget is not under pressure because of an increase in prison numbers. So it may very well be that the budget is under pressure because the Treasury has not allocated sufficient money to the department in order for it to be able to absorb the increased costs of staff. But before we decide that that is the driver and the reason for the department's budget being under pressure, let's have a look at the third variable. And the question here is, has the department improved the quality and quantity of services to prisoners? Well, the department is committed by the white paper to delivering a range of sophisticated and potentially expensive services to prisoners. There we have seen an increase in sentence plans from some just under 10,000 in 2007-08 to a projected 95,000 by the end of the mid-term expenditure period. Keeping in mind that 40,000 of those were completed in 2010, there has been an increase in sentence plans. But as civil society has brought to the attention of the committee on a number of occasions, the mere existence of a sentence plan for an offender does not necessarily mean that that person will get rehabilitation services. So just because you have a sentence plan doesn't mean that you're going to go and have a program. Those things are not necessarily related. But it is also true that if you don't have a sentence plan, you definitely can't get any services. So sentence plans are an important factor in the rollout of services. We also know that there's been no projected substantial increase in literacy training. It's remaining constant at about 4,500 a year. We also know that there's no significant increase in the rollout of skills development programs, which is at a constant of around about just under 7,000 a year. We also haven't seen that the department has changed its staffing complement, because one of the ways in which it might achieve or demonstrate that it is increasing or improving services is by changing what staff are doing, given that staff are the ones that are delivering services. So we're not really seeing that the commitments required by the white paper are reflected in the staffing allocations. Now, if you have a look at the graphics here, you can see that there was a drop in 2010 in the number of admin staff that will be recovered. The highest proportion of staff members in the department are those who are performing security functions. Now, the purpose of this report is not to knock that, because security is also an important function, given that, for example, security staff are required in order to escort prisoners from their cells to school, or to escort prisoners from their cells to courts and so on. This takes up an enormous amount of time. But one of the things that I think needs to be clear as well is that, as the Judicial Inspectorate has pointed out, the cost of admin staff is actually underrepresented here, because warders spend a significant proportion of their time also doing administrative functions. Now, the same point about the allocation of staff and so on can be made if you have a look at the projected growth over different programs. And like we said earlier, you can quite clearly see that the programs within DCS that are projected to grow the slowest are those on development, corrections, and social reintegration. So the 2011 DCS budget shows that security will grow faster than development, corrections, and social reintegration and care. But I think what we have to do now is pause and consider that in fact, since 2008, in the 2008 review of the correctional services legislation, only prisoners serving sentences of over 24 months qualify for sentence plans. So if you have a sentence of over 2 years, you qualify to get a sentence plan. If you don't, you won't. And the impact of this decision is enormous. What it means is that 70% of the people leaving prisons every year have not had a sentence plan and have not had access to any rehabilitation services. That is the impact of that policy decision not to roll out sentence plan or services to people who have short sentences. But that is the category of people who leave prison at the greatest rate, and the next graph shows that. So what this really means is that, in essence, the Department of Correctional Services is a revolving door for prisoners who are coming in, spending a very short period of time in prison, and going out, not having the benefit of receiving any rehabilitation services. Now, again, this is not a critique of the department. This is a function of policy decisions, it's a function of the budget. This is what the department has to work with. And I think it also needs to be stated very clearly that having people come in and spend 6 months in prison, 3 months in prison, and then leave comes at an enormously high administrative cost. It really does. So what we can conclude from all I've said before is that we're not seeing an increase or improvement in services. So the biggest driver of cost, given that prisoner numbers have remained the same, is the cost of staff remuneration. And I think this has driven the department to the point where it cannot realistically plan or deliver high-quality rehabilitation interventions. That's the only conclusion that can be reached, because if you look, where in the budget should it come from? So what you also have to conclude is that if the prisoner numbers increase because, for example, the police start arresting people for serious crimes and courts start processing them, we're in trouble. So let's try and see what it would cost if the department were to implement the white paper. Now, the way we have done this is illustrative. I don't think that our costing is wild, and I'll show you how we've come to this cost. But basically what we have done is in 2006, the Department of Correctional Services asked the Institute for Security Studies to undertake a study of best practice in relation to reducing reoffending. It was a partnership project between the ISS and the DCS, and what we looked at was, what are other countries, what is the best practice, what sort of program is necessary to prevent people from reoffending when they leave prison? Now, based on that study, which I'm not going to go into in detail, there is more detail in the report here if you're interested in. But if you were going to roll out effective programs, they would have some key characteristics. One, you're more likely to be effective if you roll out those programs in the community than you are if you roll them out in prison. That we know. We also know that programs have to be intensive. They need to last about 6 months. They have to be very clearly targeted to those offenders who are the highest risk of reoffending, and that you can't just make that assessment of them being at high risk of reoffending by speaking to a social worker or a psychologist. There are sophisticated tools that have been developed to undertake such a risk assessment that we have not got in South Africa at the moment. Also, cognitive behavioral techniques are used. Now, if we take that as a key element of effective programs, it has serious implications for who can run these programs. It's not just anybody. It's somebody with sufficient level of skill and knowledge and expertise to be able to run such a program. It's also important to match the person giving the program to the offender in terms of their learning styles, in terms of all sorts of things. So it's not just a case of saying, you're the therapist, take these 10 people. No, it's a far more nuanced approach, difficult in practice. Also, if you were to run successful programs they would have to include vocational training and job-enhancing opportunities. And I apologize, there is a spelling error there. But they would have to include intensive mandatory aftercare components, and there would have to be a process of monitoring and evaluating them. So some of the, if we take that as what we would like to do, if we say, all right, this is the best possible best possible program that we can roll out to achieve rehabilitation, what's it going to cost us? Well, it's going to be influenced by the number of prisoners who receive that. Going to be influenced by the number of months over which the intervention takes place, also the number of people you need to run those programs, the number of time that such an intervention would take in a day, and the ratio of trainers to people undertaking the program. I think trainer is probably not the right word for this, and also the cost of the professionals who can provide these programs. So on that basis, it's possible to calculate how many, if we call them classes, need to be provided annually, how many professionals would be involved, the cost of the professionals, the number of prisoners, and we have pegged this at 60,000. We've said that based on the fact that interventions are only available to those serving sentences of over 24 months, it's reasonable to come to a calculation that these kind of rehabilitative services would be rolled out to approximately 60,000 offenders, that the intervention will last about 6 months, as is best practice. We'll have an average class size of between 10 and 15, and the professionals can really only give one class a day. Now, then you come up with a table here, and really this is the kind of table that one can fiddle around with. What it's showing you is that if you change the number of prisoners who could receive these services, or change the duration of the intervention, or the number of classes, etc., you come up with different figures. But it is our estimation that it's going to cost anything between R1 billion and 2.4 billion rand in order to be able to provide these services. Now, this does not include, when we did this costing, we did not include the fact that it may result also in increased administrative costs. That's you may need to build classrooms, because at many of the facilities, there are not suitable facilities to run such classes. That you may need other resources like books, or I don't know what you might need, but all sorts of things like that that we haven't added in. And this could actually potentially double that cost. So we could be looking, I think your low-end figure for providing rehabilitation programs is about an additional 1 billion rand on the correctional services budget. So the question is, if we are going to justify that kind of additional spending on correctional services, given that if we were going to spend another R1 billion on correctional services, it would have to come from somewhere in the national budget. And I hope it wouldn't come from education. But it would have to come from somewhere, so there would be a trade-off. Which means that such an increase would have to be very clearly motivated, and we'd have to be sure that such programs are effective and practical, and that it's the right policy approach right now. Now, we know that overcrowding remains a problem in DCS facilities. We know also that there are a number of challenges that DCS faces in relation to humane detention. As a consequence, it is not inappropriate to ask whether, if you were going to increase the DCS's budget at all, you wouldn't rather spend it on making sure that your facilities are up to scratch and making sure that prisoners are being held in humane conditions. The other question is really, if you're going to spend R1 billion providing rehabilitation programs, can you be sure that this is actually going to reduce the amount of crime? We would have to be sure of that, I would imagine, to justify additional expenditure. The other thing is, can we be certain that if there is a reduction in crime, it's because of the programs that DCS is rolling out? And I would argue that that is going to be a very, very difficult assumption to make, even with the best evidence available. The other question that I think even DCS has identified is that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to provide rehabilitation programs to prisoners who are not living in humane conditions. When you're not eating food with a knife and fork, when you don't have a place to eat your food off, is it possible to actually rehabilitate people? And I think the answer to that is a very clear no. The other very big question, I think, is, are there actually enough dedicated qualified professionals that the DCF could recruit to roll out the kind of services envisaged in the white paper. They're not easy answers. It's not clear to me that we have all the answers, but what is clear to me is that we need to rethink whether putting a requirement on the department to develop and deliver rehabilitation when it's not practically possible is in fact the best policy option that we have at hand. It's clear, I think, that the conclusion leads us to the fact that we need to rethink what we're doing. Now, a radical suggestion, if you like, is that I think we need to reassess whether there is value in passing custodial sentences of 24 months or less. Do we really want to be sending people to prison for petty crimes, giving them sentences of 2 years or less, when we know that all that's going to happen is they're going to go into prison for a short period of time, they're going to be exposed to other criminals, they're probably going to experience inhumane conditions, and then we're going to put them out on the streets. Is this in our best interest in terms of reducing crime and addressing the problems that we face? And I would argue this is something we seriously need to interrogate. The other issue is whether minimum sentencing legislation is appropriate and whether it can achieve the objective of deterring crime. And forgive me, but I want to quote just very briefly from a report that is making waves in the United States, and I don't like using the United States as an example, but the fact is that it is a country that has a great deal of quality data for its own purposes. I'm not trying to make a comparison between the United States and South Africa. But an analysis of U.S. data by statisticians recently has come to the conclusion that there is such a marginal deterrence effect of increasing long prison sentences that it is absolutely not worth the return on investment. So long sentences are not going to achieve deterrence. I think we also need to ask this question of whether the white paper and whether offering rehabilitation services is where the DCF should be going, or whether it should be focusing on its core business, accommodating inmates humanely. I think there are other things we can look at, other options, open prisons, strengthening community corrections, establishing a better system of post-release support for prisoners, and so on. I think there are a number of creative options that one can think through, but none of us will come without asking very hard questions of whether we're on the right policy track. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Let's open it up for critique, interrogation, comment. Let me start, ma'am, while members still gather their thoughts. Maybe when you look at your recommendations, if you start with that you have on the page. I think everybody agrees, including the department, on the first bullet point, that there have to be alternate sentences for at least those that are less serious. And so I think on that one there's agreement, as well as, if my memory serves me correctly, the minister is talking about sentence plans for less than 24 months as an initiative. But I'm saying those that are less than 24 months, I think there's room for discussion, and I think there's agreement around those, whether it's sentence plans or whether it is that we consider anything other than custodial treatment. Your second one, you know, around the minimum sentences, I might agree with you, and I guess this is the fight that we have in correctional services generally. You know, if you went to the public and said to them that we're going to drop the minimum sentences because it's not a deterrent, you'd have an outcry like we have now, even with the death sentence. Even with the death sentence, we know that there is not a deterrent, but everybody's clamoring for the death sentence to come back. I'm talking about civil society outside. And I think that is it with minimum sentence. You know, on the field, people say Vincent was arrested yesterday, 3 weeks later he's out. type of thing. So they want Vincent to be arrested and locked up forever. So whilst there might be, at our level, agreement around the effectiveness or otherwise of minimum sentences, I think the real challenge would be education outside. I think that's where it is. I don't know. I mean, this is the first time. You said it was radical, so we must accept it as that. If you look at the third one, you're suggesting that correctional services must become a warehouse and rehabilitation. And when I say that, you're talking about, and we're looking at it in context of the value add or the cost. But in essence, you're saying don't do any rehabilitation, go and just make it a warehouse. I'm not sure that, from where I'm sitting, I would agree with that right now. But maybe you must explain why you're saying that. So those are the three things around there that I wanted to talk about. But, you talk about the personnel costs, which we all agree to. And then you had a slide somewhere that spoke about the cost of rehabilitation. And I got a sense that you were saying, let us do this rehabilitation, or let's outsource this rehabilitation. I thought that's what we were saying when we said this is the cost of the trainer or the private sector or whoever could use it. I don't know. I think we would have to have a discussion on, one, are we saying we can rehabilitation, or two, are we saying that if we do rehabilitation, it's best done by people outside of correctional services, and how does that help the cost drivers? Because if we do it outside of correctional services, are we then saying that we must get rid of the 40 or part of the 41,000 people? I'm not sure what you're saying about the numbers of personnel versus the rehabilitation. So those are the issues that maybe you can start with, and then members can engage with any other matters. Let's take those, and then we'll come to you, Baba, if you have, and then we'll come to Mama Gwenya if she has any, and then we'll come to Baba Gwele if they have any, and if you take it in that order, ma'am. No, but we'll, yeah, you can.
Thank you very much. Just perhaps to clarify on the last two points that you raised, when we are saying don't rehabilitate, I don't think that we are saying warehouse. I think that we are being very specific about rehabilitation. We're being clear that rehabilitation involves rehabilitation as opposed to job training and as opposed to education. I think that all civil society organizations are quite committed or quite clear about the fact that inmates should have access to education, should have access to literacy training if necessary, should have the ability to spend time out of their cells doing practical work. What we've tried to cost is providing really rehabilitation programs that the DCS is not currently providing, except on a small scale, and those rehabilitation programs involve sex offender programs, it is anger management, and it's alcohol and drug abuse programs. What we're saying is that if DCS, and we are not saying outsource, we've never been a proponent of outsourcing. What we're saying is that if the Department of Correctional Services were to deliver rehabilitation programs that are run according to international best practice, which of course could be modified for South Africa, but contain those principles at least, it would cost the department R1 billion more than it has right now, at least. So in other words, what we're saying is whether DCS staff themselves do it or whether it's outsourced is kind of irrelevant to the fact that it's going to cost the department at least another R1 billion on top of its existing budget if it were to do that. So what we're saying is that the DCS can't, within its existing budget, provide rehabilitation services, and we must stop fooling ourselves that it can. Because what the effect of the white paper is to put the commitment on DCS to do something that it cannot do. Now, it may be aspirational, and maybe the argument is is that it's important to have aspirational policy that will lead you over time somewhere. But I think we also have to be realistic in our policy making. And I think this is what this report is clearly showing, is let's hold DCS accountable for those things that they actually can do. And let's get that right. Let's get the core business right. The other thing I just wanted to comment on is in relation to the minimum sentencing legislation. Now, I agree with you that we have a very retributive, certainly the media would give the impression that we have a retributive society. When somebody is wronged, they want to see that person going to jail and for a long time, preferably. That is the impression the media creates. That impression is not actually borne out by research that has been done by NICRO and others, which suggests that in fact society is somewhat less retributive than the media would give us the impression it is. But I don't disagree with you that you would have a huge outcry at first and that any kind of shift on minimum sentencing would have to be backed up by a strong public campaign. But I don't think it's impossible. I don't think that should be a deterrent to making policy that is sensible.
Just before I move, just interrogate those two things. You know, I'm saying that, and then I don't know that anybody would disagree with me then. Almost weekly we get a story in the media that says that Vincent was on parole, and whilst on parole he went and raped somebody else. So why put him on parole? I'm saying that's the reality on the ground. So from where I'm sitting, I think that society is in fact vengeful. I really do think so. Where I come from, I can tell you that's what they say. He's on parole. He murdered somebody, he's on parole, and he's done it again. I mean, I can tell you of a case, and the minister told us this the other day, that somebody was sentenced to death for killing his wife, went on parole, killed the second wife, went back in, and now he's eligible for parole again. And she knows that there's going to be a problem. So I think that there is. That's why I said there has to be public education. We agree with you, but we're just saying that it's not as simple as removing that. The other thing that you're saying, and if you're saying that somebody must go and work and go and learn how to be a panel beast and all those things, and it must happen, you agree, but we should question whether DCS should be looking at alcohol abuse rehabilitation, sexual behavior rehabilitation, and anger management rehabilitation. If they don't do it, who must do it? Because that's the question. Unless you are saying that even if we didn't look at it, we'd be a better place. Because I don't know that if correctional services who have that captive market, if they don't do it, who will do it? Because sometimes we hear that many of the people that are in there is because of the seriousness of the case. It's not the crime that is the problem, but it's the violence, the nature of the crime. And all these things you're talking about, sexual, anger management, is that type of thing. If we're not going to do that correctional services, you might have to indicate to us who must do it. Because I'm saying that would be our argument. I can tell you DCS will be saying, if you're not going to do that, then who's going to do those type of things? So those are the two things. You don't have to respond to them now, but we would have to respond to them during the course of the discussions. But let's allow Bishop Tolo to raise whatever points, and you've got about 10-15 minutes to engage with the department. With the ISS, I beg your pardon.
You know, Comrade Jefferson, truly speaking, you are right. You know, people who stay in town, maybe in suburb, there's a difference between someone who stays in township or rural area. The point you raised, Comrade Jefferson, there were some other gentlemen killed because they were hoping from there they were shooting, kill a woman. That woman, she was a white woman, and she was pregnant, painful, and she died. And he went to prison. And when he came back with a parole, if I'm not mistaken, 15 to 18 years, he killed another woman, went back to prison. And now, the people there in the rural area, when they see, they say, no, it's government who caused this kind of problem. Because we know this person is very dangerous. Now he's here, so he's killing somebody. The point you raise is, truly speaking, very petty crime. It's happening, but also they must teach people. The organization goes there, grassroots also, to teach, to talk to the people. Because the people, when they see this gentleman come back, they start to criticize the government also. To say, no, look, this man is stealing my something here, clothing and back. And they say, tomorrow I'll show you. You see, those kind of things. Now the people are starting to say, we must look into. And I said, young man, I'm going to kill you. And it's a terrible start to prove to you because the gentleman said, right. But now my question on your organization, on this prison number, you are from 1995 and 2003. You know, I just find out from 1994 till today, 2011. Because here I see 165,000. I just find out before 1994, down there, in prison, and the statistics in prison, there was overcrowding like now, or it was lesser now, or it was now. Let's say if before 1994 down, in prison there was overcrowding, now it's better. What was caused before 1994 down there? Maybe overcrowding is so high, or it was less. Why now it's now more than 65,000? You know, last week in my where I'm staying and Kukuni, this young boy that caused a problem. In the mind, there's a mind next to us. They say they don't like causal speaking to welfare. And they don't want social speaking and other people who come outside. See, it's a problem. So around those young men, all of them, they're out amongst them. Now these things, they make people feel not happy. Now I just found out this 36 men before 1994 or 1994 to hear what was the statistic? What was number? And now because it's 159 to 165,000 now.
Thank you very much. I think that unfortunately I can't answer your question in relation to the numbers before 1994 because at this stage I don't have the answer to that at my fingertips. We can find that out. I'm going to ask Caleb to make a note of that and we can provide that information to you. But at this stage, I don't have access to that data, so I can't tell you. I haven't been working in this sector for long enough to be able to remember. Yes, sir.
The numbers
level of overcrowding.
The possible
reasons. Yes. Okay, we've got that. All right, we'll endeavor to answer that. I don't think we are arguing that there are not individuals who have to be removed from society in order to protect society. We've been undertaking interviews with repeat violent offenders, and there's no question in my mind that there are individuals who it would be a danger to society if they were released. No question. And I think people have justifiable concerns if violent criminals or psychopaths who have operated in their communities return. What I think we're saying is that we need to not make the mistake of believing that prison can solve the causes or the motivations for people committing crimes. In the same way, as rehabilitation programs provided on an ad hoc basis to a small percentage of offenders, women, if it is maybe possible, because our budget doesn't allow for more than that, is going to be able to solve our problem either. The fact is that crime and the cause that is motivating young men to be involved in violent crime is something that we have to deal with using other means other than prison. Prison is an expensive and ineffective way of doing that. Let's not pretend it isn't. So if there's, and I know that this committee is focused on the Department of Correctional Services, so it's outside of the committee to be thinking about what some of those other interventions are. But I think it would be extremely dangerous to make the mistake that prison is going to solve our crime problem. And putting people in prison for longer is even a better solution. I don't think any evidence supports that analysis.
Indicate, and if you, I'm saying roughly here now, or at least bring it to us, you know, the less than 24 months, what type of crime is the less than 24 months type of crime? Because you see, if we got rid of that less than 24 months, then I don't think we'd have an overcrowding problem. If we dealt with the remand and the less than 24 months, then we'd have an ideal world to do everything. So if you could give us an indication of what are the typical offences that somebody commits that's less than 24 months, so that we can interrogate them. Because if you take Bishop Tolo's scenario, you know, if you said to me, and I'm not sure that's why we need to interrogate it, if breaking and entering burglary, for instance, is that less than 24 months? If it's less than 24 months, for instance, and we said that somebody that broke into your house didn't kill anybody but just broke in and took your TV, is less than 24 months, therefore you must get alternate sentences, we might pick up a problem, because that is one of the very emotional things. So if you guys came and said, look, or even DCS, I'm not sure who, somebody must be able to say to us, the typical less than 24 month sentences are stealing, a shoplifting, it's fine, but what else is it? So that we are then able to say, well, if we advocate for alternate sentences, then we must be sure that we are not going to alienate society. Because I think breaking into my house and you say to that person he mustn't even go to jail for a night could be a problem in the locations and the suburbs. So somebody could give us that type of an analysis of what is less than 24 months. But I agree, if we were able to get everybody less than 24 months to do sentences other than custodial, it might help us a whole lot. But we need to know what categories they are. Mamgwenya, you've got time to fight, interrogate, agree with ISS, and also Nicro there in the corner. They must also respond because you co-own this document.
Thank you, Chapatin. Chair, on page 6, the document of the presentation mentioned that this S has commissioned 3 new triple-pays present. In this, the new number of triple-P present, because of this S mentioned 4 triple present. I want the explanation on that. Also, on page 7, you also mentioned that DCS budget is divided between 6 programs, whereas the DCS is currently operating with 7 budget programs. Can you get the explanation again there? And in your presentation again, you mentioned that the policy arrested more people who commit less serious crime, but we have a large number of offenders who stay in prison long. And I want to know, how do you explain this? I did hear you, but I want to say something in your prison, in your...
I'm going to let them answer those, and then you can do a follow-up if they are, and then you'll ask the rest. I'm afraid that they will miss some of your questions that you've asked. Let them just deal with those. You can do a follow-up, and then you'll ask the next set. Immediately before we go to good. Otherwise, if you ask them too many, they won't answer all of them.
Okay, nice try.
Right. Yes.
First of all, are there any of my colleagues who would like to take those questions? You want me to take them? Okay. Thank you very much, Angrenia. Just perhaps to note, in relation to the PPPs, what we're saying on that page is that DCS has not commissioned those. Not that it has commissioned, but it hasn't. So what we're saying is that money that would have been in the DCS budget for the PPP prisons is not going to be spent now. We don't know where the PPP process is at right now, so that's just a clarity on that. And in relation to your query on page 7, you're absolutely right that the 6 is an error. It should be 7, in fact. So thank you for picking that up. I'll make that a correction to the document. The third one was in... Oh, the third question... Okay, so and just to be clear, that the numbers on that graph about police arrests come from the police's own annual report. So just so that you know that those two, where those figures come from. What we're saying is that the police are arresting a lot of people. Most of the people that they are arresting are for crimes less serious than shoplifting. Now that comes about because, and I know you didn't ask why it comes about, but I'll give some context. That comes about, we believe, to some extent because of the police's own performance requirements. So, when we know anecdotally that this is the case. So a police commander comes on duty and says to his members, when you go out tonight, I want you to effect 10 arrests, because that way we can show that we're being effective. Well, you can be guaranteed that the police officer is going to go out and arrest a sex worker. They're going to go out and arrest somebody for drinking on the road. They're going to harass a homeless person, because that's easy to do. It's far more difficult to go out and make 10 arrests for serious crimes. Your question really related to why are we having so many people serving long sentences if the police are arresting. I think the answer to that is that there are still a significant number of crimes that are committed, that are detected, that are in fact prosecuted and that result in conviction if somebody sits in prison. But if the police were doing a better job arresting those who are committing serious violent crimes, we'd have far more people in prison than we do now. I don't know if that goes some way to answering your question.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got the answer. Yeah, for all these three, but I've got two that is left. Then, in your assessment, how long does programs provided by DCS last on average? And the last one, Chairperson, I was expected the presentation to also talk about prison labor and self-sufficiency, but I don't get anything from the document. Thank you, Chief.
I wonder, Chair, if it would be possible to direct the question about the average length of programs to the Department of Correctional Services. I don't know the answer to that question, and I understand my colleagues from NICRO don't either at this stage. Alternatively, we can seek to find the answer, but I presume that those in the department would be best equipped to answer that. And that goes to the question you asked about what offences people receive sentences of 24 months and less. I think that would be appropriately directed at the department who has that information at their fingertips. For us to obtain that information is somewhat more difficult. So,
That's fine. Okay. In our engagement, we will put those questions on hold until then. So they'll be pending. Somebody's going to ask it. What are the typical sentences less than 24 months? You need to go and do that homework for us. And the question of what is the average time spent on rehabilitation. We're not talking about skills development or whatever. We're talking about real rehabilitation, anger management, sexual abuse. Because I think let's distinguish between rehabilitation and skills development, because we tend to put these things together. Alcohol abuse, anger management, sexual behavior, rehabilitation. What is the average time spent on an inmate and those two things? If the department could come back with those type of answers for us. The others you can respond to.
And then perhaps I'd like to make some comment on that, just if you don't mind, Tay. But I would also like them to acknowledge that the report does not deal with prison labor and self-sufficiency. And partly because for us as civil society to be able to do a cost-benefit analysis of that requires us to have information that is not easily available to us. So what we have to do with this report is kind of decide what should the focus of this report be. And when we sat together as civil society with the consultant who assisted us, our decision was that the focus of the report should be looking at what is the DCS budget doing now, what should it be doing, what would it look like if it was going to meet the requirements of the white paper, and what are our findings in that regard. So in a sense it's quite a focused report. And the issues that you raise are of importance, but they are outside the scope of this report. Should you wish us to undertake further research, we'd have to certainly take that request seriously and consider whether it's possible for us to do that. But I also think that might be something that the department would be able to do more easily than civil society. In relation to programs, perhaps I can just point to some of the devil is in the detail with programs. Now, let's take, for example, research that has already been published, undertaken by Rudolf Zinn. Now, one might want, there are several reasons why I'm hesitant in drawing on this research, but at least I think that the research undertaken by Rudolf Zinn on house robbers is instructive for at least one reason. It tells us that by the time somebody comes to DCS for being given a sentence for house robbery, they have already committed in excess of 100 crimes in some cases, which haven't been detected. So when they come to the Department of Correctional Services as a first-time offender for house robbery, which you might say is motivated by your internal anger that needs to be managed, you're not taking into consideration all the other things that have happened in this person's life. In other words, providing them with an anger management course might make you feel better about the fact that you're doing something. But whether it can really affect a change in that individual is questionable. There might be very good anecdotal cases of this happening. I would imagine that the evidence is scarce on whether that is having an impact on crime levels and on the propensity of that person to reoffend.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I want to make a recommendation that the presentation of this report is very important to us. But also, Chair, I would like to say we still need more civil society to participate on this correctional savings portfolio committee. Thank you, Chairperson.
All right. I don't know if you answered it, but somebody's going to have to answer the question around what do we do about alcohol abuse, sexual behavior, anger management? Because I seem to be getting and I could agree with it, if we're talking about the amount of money we have and value add for that money, that we are putting or we are wasting resources if we think we can rehabilitate somebody. If we're doing it for less than, if the ideal is six months or whatever the case might be, anything less than 6 months, we're wasting money, so therefore don't put it there. I could live with that. But the question then is, what do we do with this person that has got so much pent-up anger, somebody who is just cannot take alcohol without going to beat somebody up or stab somebody? Or what do we do with those individuals in society? Because they will continuously be a problem to us. Correctional services don't do it if we don't have the money. We can live with that. Who must do it? Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. Just to answer that, I think we need to understand the definition of rehabilitation as well. Right now, we're confining it to rehabilitation programs, anger management, sexual offenses, and whatever else. I think in my previous submission, I did say that rehabilitation is a broader concept. How do you rehabilitate a person? That means from being a law breaker to becoming a law-abiding citizen. And I think Chandra has alluded to that in the presentation through many different means, from creating a humane environment, to skills training, vocational training. It's more than just providing those training. If you get a skill, if you are able to be employable, it adds more to what you can contribute to society. We have found that that's how offenders change their behavior. It's much more than just having those specialized programs. But to answer then your question about the specialized programs, because in the ideal world, what we are saying about rehabilitation is in the South African context, we cannot afford to implement the sophisticated model that the white paper proposes. With our current resources and overcrowding, it's impossible. But we can try to get the best value for what we can do. To answer that question, what can be done? The DCS is also liaising with non-governmental organizations, community-based organizations. Now, there are many of these organizations that have specialized programs such as these. And not to just advocate for my own organization, but there's lots of organizations out there, and it is part of the DCS's plan to liaise with other stakeholders. Now, I know Chandra has said it's not about bringing consultants in, but we have to make use of the civil society programs that are available. It may be in our best interest. These people have been trained. They have specialist programs. Maybe there's some way we can look at how we can utilize that resource. From civil society, yes, it is problematic to offer the service free of charge to the Department of Correctional Services because primarily it was meant to be their role. So we may have to negotiate those kinds of things, but there are, I don't know how many, and we need to look at that, how many NGOs offer services to the DCS, but they're a significant number. So we need to look at that. So maybe we can look at that combination, but have as your bare minimum the humane detention, the skills training, and also kind of broaden the concept of rehabilitation. Because if we look at skills development, we can have several outcomes as to what just having a classroom environment, learning teamwork, learning how to respect one another, basic life skills, is what is at the core of rehabilitation. So we can look how we do those programs, skills, vocational, prison labor, but look at it with a broader goal of rehabilitating offenders. So the DCS does not then give away its mandate to rehabilitate in that broader sense, but to do the sophisticated things. So I don't know if that answers a little bit.
Going closer to somewhere, because then we can argue, because I mean my understanding, and members can raise it, we're going to allow you to come in later on, but on this one, I think what I'm hearing Vanessa saying is that we should maybe be putting more emphasis on reskilling, upskilling, and that type of thing, as opposed to going to somebody to say when you're angry, take a deep breath, or whatever the case might be. And we agree with that. The only challenge that I have, and I've been advocating this recently, and I think there's now people beginning to believe, if we do what you are saying, we've got 241 centers. We can't be everything to everybody. Then we must move away from this thing of centers of excellence to centers of expertise. If what you're saying is correct, then it gives me more ammunition to say, then we must, if reskilling is going to do the other things that as byproducts, then I do think we're going to have to move away from saying Sun City in Johannesburg will teach you all these things and move it to say Sun City in Johannesburg is going to focus on panel beating, for instance. Because then there will be a deeper content in terms of the reskilling, as opposed to right now everybody wants to teach somebody panel beating. Everybody wants to teach somebody painting around. It's just not possible in the country. So I think we can argue, and I think you're giving us more ammunition to do that type of thing, that we move away from being everything to everybody in every center to specializing, so that, because the byproduct of that is the rehabilitation. And I'm looking at the members, and maybe we must look at it that way, that says maybe instead of throwing money at psychologists and psychiatrists, I don't know what these people are, although they are necessary, as Vanessa is saying, maybe getting the artisans or the trainers of trainers might have to take a bigger priority, because Winston comes out there, qualified panel beater, he probably will not be angry, or as angry as he was if he was not qualified. So I'm saying those are the type of arguments, and we welcome them, but we will continue to debate them. We will take them to the minister and to the department. I'm raising it so that members must challenge me or you if you think that we're misinterpreting it, but I'm using it for my own ammunition. But yes, ma'am. And members can interrogate it, then we'll go to Robert Bell as well.
Now, just to reiterate, I'm not saying that we don't have dangerous offenders that need more than that. And that's why I'm saying let's not exclude the fact that let's look at the resources we do have that are in the country at the moment before we look at, okay, what is the DCS capacity and what do we still need to employ there. So maybe employing the professionals we would use to run those programs, for instance, could be some of the savings. But by no means, and I'm saying let's do that, but let's not do away completely with the fact that, let's use the resources we have. So as much as DCS doesn't have to, there's still an opportunity for somebody else to offer it.
The other question then, Vanessa and Chandra, if I could use their names. You know, just now we were arguing that let's target those that are less than 24 months, because it will deal with a lot of our overcrowding, inhumaneness, and so on. Or shorter sentences. Let's even say 3 years or 4 years. If we deal with those people, we do a lot with getting rid of this thing. Most of these dangerous people that you're talking about are serving 10 years and more. My argument is, should we be focusing our scarce resources on somebody that is going to be in prison for 20 years? As opposed to somebody that's going to be there for 3 years. Because the 3-year guy, he do what you're talking about, Vanessa, but he needs to be a panel feature type of thing. I mean, the question that I'm asking you is, how much of the rehabilitation side do we need for, let me put it to you differently. For me to make an impact, I think we need to focus people on 5 years and less. I'm making that as my statement. Those that are sentenced to 5 years and less, whether the first 24 months must not even go in at all, if they go in, that type of thing. So assuming that I'm only talking to those that are 5 years and less that are sentenced, I would argue that let's skill them whilst we need them to get their heads right, type of thing. The question that I'm asking you is, how do we balance that? If that is the target range we're talking about, is it 80% reskilling, 50%, or is it difficult to look at it? Because I want to go to the department and say, stop giving rehabilitation, training, psychological, or whatever it is, to somebody that's there for 30 years. Do it to him in his last 5 years, for instance, or whatever the case might be. Because I just sometimes think that you have Mangaung that has people that are going to be there for 100 years. And if we took that Mangaung prison and we took it to everybody that was less than 24 years, I think we'd have more of an impact. I'm saying that whole thinking. So the question that you would have to answer or have to help us with when we argue this thing is, if we took the those that are less than 5 years, what is the mechanism that we need to use for maximum value for money, balancing skills to rehabilitation? Because once we have a feeling for that, we are able then to say to the budget developers, no guys, move your budget to this, because many a time their budget is focused on things that you said, Vanessa, we're never going to see the fruits of them in many instances. I mean, R1 billion for those two prisons. Those prisons are basically looking at people that are going to spend 30, 40 years there. Shouldn't that R1 billion be used for people that are going to be for 5 years? And I'm saying, if you're going to ask hard questions, let's ask all the hard questions. And put that on the table and then say, how do we go about it? I'm just asking, so if we took the less than 5 years, in fact, let us change the goalposts if members allow me. Can this discussion be for people that are serving 5 or less, because I think that is where we need rehab and those type of things. If we just look at those figures and then how do you respond to that type of thing? Those beyond 5 years, well, we'll see to them when we come. But the first priority should be those that are serving 5 or less years. And let us focus on those from a value for money point of view, from an effectiveness on rehabilitation, effectiveness on skills development, effectiveness on self-sufficiency, or whatever else we're talking about. Mom Gwenya, do you want to, are you concluded, or we'll go to Kuele, or do we just open it up now for discussion? You don't have anything, Mom. All right, let's open it up for discussions. I'll put all those questions. Just, we are asking you to help us to convince the department that their budget is wrong, and we agree with you that the current budget allocations are just not correct. In other words, the 30% for admin and so on. The department continuously says to us, they agree with us, but it's not going to happen overnight. And I think we're becoming lax as a committee, and we're saying, okay, as long as you've acknowledged that it's wrong, we will then give you the time to change it. But having this discussion with you, maybe we shouldn't be giving them that time to change it. We should be saying to them, no, but these things can be changed tomorrow if you just change thinking. So that's what we want you to help us with. What are the immediate things that we can do? And if you're saying, well, stop the rehabilitation, then we must stop it. Then we must stop the rehabilitation and then just look at self-sufficiency. Mr. Abrams was here, he probably would agree with it. Then they can't have a budget that has 30% for personnel costs and something else. So that is what we want to argue. We want to change that budget. The question is how. They're saying to us it's going to take us a long time. We think that we don't have the luxury of time.
Mr. Smith, I wonder if I may jump in here. I think that there are two things that I want to comment on. The first is that, as a researcher, I don't like making recommendations that aren't based on evidence, so it's very difficult for me to jump suddenly from 2 to 5 years and say that I think this is a good idea. My gut tells me that I think you're onto the right thing here. And it makes enormous amount of sense to me to say, let's say that those people who are sentenced to periods of incarceration for 5 years or less should be the ones that we focus our resources on, because it's logical to me that that's where you'll get your best return on investment. I agree with you. Having said that, however, we also know that what the evidence does tell us is that those kind of programs, whether it's rehabilitation or skills training, are only going to be really successful if they take place outside of prison. So putting that person into prison for 5 years and then trying to rehabilitate, reskill, no, let's shift that. Prison is not the place where that's going to happen. So if they shift that and we say that must happen now, I'm just going to think wildly here now. Okay.
Mr. Smith, now, you know, the rules of Parliament, Honorable Chairperson, and so on. So let's try to correct that.
Thank you for the correction. My apologies, it won't happen again. There was, on last Friday, I was at a presentation by an academic from Rutgers University in the US who's been doing research on incarceration for many years in that country. One of the things that the policy discussion that is happening there at the moment goes like this. We know that prison doesn't work in terms of either deterrence or rehabilitation. We know that prison is enormously expensive as a policy option and as a solution to society's problems. We also know that there are costs associated with imprisoning somebody that you can't calculate just by calculating the cost of that person being in prison every day. So, for example, we need to keep in mind that what happens very often
is that if you were to map crime and imprisonment, you'll find to a large extent that there's an overlap. In those communities where there's a lot of crime, very often there also are a lot of people who are coming in and out of prison. If you consider the fact that within those communities, children are growing up in households where they have a member of family in prison, and the children who grow up with a member of family in prison are 4 times more likely than other children to come into conflict with the law themselves, then the cost of imprisonment is very much higher than what we put into the budget. So if they say, all right, we are spending, say, a thumbs up here, we're spending R1 million a year keeping somebody in prison at any prison in South Africa, if you like. If we say, let's take that money that we would have, this is the discussion that's happening in the United States. I'm just trying to inform the debate here. If we say, let's take that money, and so if we use that R1 million and we gave it to either an organization or in fact a private sector company that sets up and says, all right, what we're going to do, we'll give you that R1 million to provide this person with employment, to make sure that they go and meet their parole officer when they need to make sure that they attend a anger management course once a day, or whatever, once a week or whatever. If we reinvest that money into society, instead of investing that money in prison, we're probably going to get a better return on investment. That's the policy discussion happening not here. So what it says to me is that the things that we need to start to, and I just as I say, I heard this on Friday, there's a great deal, we would need to do that work in South Africa to determine whether that's an kind of argument that would work here. But I think the principles of that is right, is that we need to look at ways of spending money that don't require spending more money on prisons. I don't want to see an increase in the DCS budget, but I'm also sympathetic to the fact that within its current budget and given its current inmate population and given its current staffing levels, the DCS cannot spend more money on skilling, rehabilitation, or care. We've seen that those things, unless you're going to lay off a lot of staff, and the consequence of that is going to be people will sit in their cells for 24 hours. So you're not going to get a benefit by saying we're going to spend less on staffing and more on development because there won't be anyone to do that development. So right now within the DCS budget, I don't believe that there's a space to say, let's bring that down and bring that up. No. The budget is too stretched. So we have to be really creative.
No, my comment is, and I'm glad Shanri said that from the same evidence, but obviously we're in agreement that that's a priority, because when people are coming out of prison, they need to have benefited from imprisonment. But we cannot leave the other population unattended to, and this is where prison labor, they should not be excluded from all of those things. You know, work, exercise, we mustn't leave all of that out. So maybe, we prioritize it and figure out how we're going to prioritize that. But, make sure that we're not sending people to prison for, just as you said, warehousing them.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I was just carefully listening to the research, to the study that they did. But for me, it seems we are going far about this, because if you employ a person outside, you said you have to be responsible that this prisoner get work, get everything well after his term. For me, you are opening another prison outside, because you can't say, just take care for this one prison. You come with the number of prisons, of the prisoners, and then all those prisoners go to that private prison company or private institution that you have, you request, and then that is another prison, because it would be like, yes, we are still in prison, but we are outside because we were together. because I think we're going to channel them one way, because they'll be doing one way of taking them out of the mind. So I think we have to brainstorm, as you say, Jefferson, is something that we have to brainstorm on, I think.
Thanks, Jefferson. I think when we focus on reskilling these offenders, so that when they go out, they'll be able to stand a chance to be employed. And like you said, Chair, that maybe perhaps this would, in a way, deal with that particular anger that they had before they went to prison. But I think when we raise this issue, particularly this one of reskilling offenders for the purpose of them being employable, we also need to take into account that outside you've got thousands of people who are unemployed, in fact millions, and we have thousands of graduates, particularly those who went to the so-called vocational training schools, FET. Maybe what we need to do also is to check the number of those unemployed graduates that are there outside who cannot find employment, and try to be realistic and check as to whether how are we going to match that with those people, particularly because this offender, the offenders are going to compete with people who don't have criminal record, for instance. And we know in most cases employers are reluctant to employ these people. So what would be the effect, particularly to these ex-offenders who were reskilled in correctional institutions and now they cannot get employment? Are they not going to be more angry to say that we spend time in prison, we've got the skills, now we don't want to employ us? I think when we raise these issues, we also need to try and raise this one on the other side and try to create balance at the same time. Thank you.
Honorable Chairperson, you know, as a rural man, you know, I'm saying rural Kenya, you know, to start to know Negro and so on, just when I'm arriving in Cape Town. Now, I just find out this presentation is very important, very, very important. But I just find out, do you also go to rural area to go there also to teach the people about rehabilitation? Or it just come to portfolio committee, or maybe the presentation teach us the portfolio committee, or go out also mobilize community? When somebody comes from prison, arriving in your area, 1, 2, 3. Are you do those kind of programs? Because if you just telling us, and I think it's very important also to go out, Jefferson, to teach the community to understand about these things. You know, Jefferson, my sister, last born, she's born 1960. And her dad was in prison. Truly speaking, today when you see, he's on parole now. When he's going up and down, he's got every day newspaper. You know, he now is a real good man. He's a real good man. And as a member of the Portfolio Committee of Correctional Services, I'm trying to talk to the people to rehabilitation. When the chap come home, she must 1, 2, 3. Now I just want to ask you, as an organization, do you do those kinds of drugs or what? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Chapter
10, I think in terms of the rehabilitation, the department is doing very well, but the challenge that we are facing is the inmate itself, and I'm talking about ex-offenders. To me, it looks like we are wasting money, because these people, when they're outside, it's so difficult for them to get work. I always ask myself, why are we spending so lot of money like this for people that when they are out, they are not going to get help? And I hear this lady, who is it? Her name? Shandu, talking about another suggestion. And it's going to create a problem for this government if we can follow that. Because of this unemployment that we face in South Africa. For example, Chair, you can see our schools, the way they are, and check the inmates that the schools that are built for them. Still, the challenge, people that are shouting us outside. They're saying inmates are living in the 5-star hotel, they've got all these facilities, but we're outside, we don't have. But I mean, it's our work, even ourselves, to plan for correctional service department. So that's why I said, Chair, we need a more civil society, because we need to make sure that everybody is involved of this thing of correctional service rehabilitation. In my constituency, Chair, I was making a workshop whereby I was calling all ex-offenders. They were even crying when they explained about not getting employed. And they're very skilled. It's where I ask myself, what are we doing? Why are we putting so lot of budget like this for people that are not going to get help outside? I think we need to think thoroughly about correcting this. And some of them is not to say they go back because they want in the prison. I'll make example with a child that is staying at a rural. That child was out in the prison with parole, but the owner of the farm told the parents that I don't want your child in my farm. And where is the child gonna stay? That's why I said we need you more, because that person, if he's out, is not our responsibility or the responsibility of the DCF. It must be responsibility of you guys as civil society to make sure that that inmate is accepted by the community outside, moreover at the rural. So your focus mustn't only at the urban area, even in the rural, because they're living with Makosi, some of them, they're living with the farmers, some of them, and if the farmer said, your child has been proven, then I don't want your child in my farm, then that parent now is in the crisis of the child, that where am I going to take my child to? Now it shows that we've got a lot of work that we need to do together to make sure that our ex-offenders are accepted in the community. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
before you respond, you come in. Mam Gwenya, just quick my memory, and Cindy will have to do some feedback on that one. You know, I never dreamt that I will live to see what I saw or experienced. I think it was last week. Somebody in Johannesburg is on parole at Leoko. I think his parole was for about a year. And on the 1st of May, his parole expires and he becomes a free man. He's on day parole. So he goes back to Leeuwkop every night. 1st of May, his parole expires. That man has written to me, and he phoned me this morning, that's why I'm saying Cindy must follow up, to say, please extend my day parole. Please extend my day parole. Cindy received the letter last week, and we've asked the minister and the commissioner, are we able to do this thing? He phoned me this morning, Cindy, that's why you need to follow it up, because he is now so anxious that on the 1st of May, his day parole expires, and he's a free man. And he knows that society will not accept him, stroke, he's not ready to go into society. Please extend my parole until 2012. That's his request. Please extend my day parole until 2012. I'm talking about a real case that DCS have got with them now. So, we really have all these things. I don't know how we deal with these things. I don't know how we deal with them. So when we say to somebody, don't go in, it might be ideal for us. But the actual inmate, I don't know. I mean, I said to him, now what's your problem? If you're on parole and it's expiring, I would have imagined you'd be happy. He says, no, Mr. Smith, please go and extend it for me. What do we do? So I think we just have serious challenges in correctional services. I don't know how we're going to resolve them. But we need to take our 6 billion rand, or 16 billion rand, and make it value for money. I think we need to do it. We can't throw our hands up in the air and say, well, we can't do anything about it. And I think it's a useful exercise in that regard. But I thought I should share that with you so that you guys can assist us. I'm waiting for the department to tell me, and please follow it up with both the minister and the commissioner, because I spoke to the minister personally on Thursday, and we sent the letter on Friday. This guy is going on parole on the 1st of May, and he desperately wants to have his day parole extended for a year. Otherwise, he's going to become another statistic in correctional services, according to him. Well, okay.
Thanks, sir. I think I must take the opportunity to thank you, sir, for asking the NGOs to come with their input, not to come and cry to us. Yeah. The reason why I'm saying this is that I'm learning new things now about the budget. That this budget that we have just approved, I think we need to relook at it so that it will talk to the white paper. And also go through the documents that have been given to us by the NGOs as well, and study them thoroughly, not to accept what they are saying, but to study and analyze everything. I see the presentation, the presenter talked about the slowest in the growth of some of the programs by the DCS. She mentioned the social reintegration and others. I just want to find out what is the reason behind the slower growth, if you may share with us in your own thinking. Thanks, sir.
Yes. Any of the inputs that you want to support, you can respond to anybody.
I'm going to let Vanessa answer the question about engaging with rural communities, just to say that I also come from a rural community and live in a rural area, so I have a great deal of sympathy for the need for information and resources to go back. But our organization, Institute for Security Studies, we are a research organization. We undertake research for policy purposes. Sometimes our research takes us to rural areas, sometimes it takes us to libraries. sometimes it takes us to Parliament. Our focus is not on providing canvassing or education or training. I think NICRO is far more equipped to answer that. What we try to do is provide the information so that people in government and people in Parliament can make decisions. In relation to this question about why social reintegration grows the slowest, I don't know the answer. But I think what we, you know, I think it's very important to keep in mind two things. What our report is saying is that in its simplest form, what the report is saying is given the 16.8 billion rand that the department has, given the number of staff it has, and if we accept that that number of staff can't be reduced if we want prisoners to be housed safely, securely, and humanely, if we can't change the number of staff, we can't make the budget bigger because we don't want to, and if we can't change the number of prisoners, then we can't do anything to realign this budget with the white paper. We have to go and ask the question, is the white paper the right policy? This is the stark reality of what our analysis is telling us. So it's not going to help for us to fiddle within the existing budget. But one thing that I want to reiterate that Vanessa was saying is that it is our belief that if we were to be housing all inmates humanely. In other words, they had time outside of their cells, their cells were not overcrowded, they were eating with knives and forks and all the other things that goes with that. You have a better chance of somebody coming out who is going to be able to be cope in society than if you don't address those core fundamentals. So rather let's get that right and then think about the other things.
Goes on. Let's agree. I think what is coming out is that we don't have much influence on the number of prisoners. When I say we, I'm saying correctional services and ourselves. We don't. In fact, it's conservative as it is. If the police did their job properly, it could get worse, is what we are saying. I don't think that we're going to get a budget increase, substantial budget increase, because of all these other competing requirements. Those are two things that we know about. Our only avenue is to change how BCS does its work. It's the only thing that we have to change, if we are serious about it. And what is coming out is that the roadmap of the white paper that is being followed is in fact the wrong roadmap. In the simplest of terms, that's what it's saying. Because you talk to them, they say to them that we are informed by the white paper and our budgets or our work, our strategy is trying to address the white paper. We think that the white paper, or when I say we, I'm saying what we're getting, is people are saying, in fact, you are using the wrong math. If you're not going to have more money, if the inmates are not going to change, and of course, if the officials are not going to change, we're not going to be able to fire people. If those things remain constant, or relatively constant, the only thing we can do to realize value for money is to change the roadmap. And what they are proposing is that maybe we should consider forgetting about this idealistic approach of trying to rehabilitate them by ways of getting anger management away and sexual, because it's not working. Let's rather take that money and use it where we get more value for money. That's really what is coming out of our discussion today. We have to convince South African society, and they're also saying that maybe the minimum sentence, I mean the things we spoke about earlier that we are forgetting, minimum sentence is part of the problem. Those are the real challenges that when we go and argue with the minister or anybody, we must expect. We know that people are complaining that somebody goes to jail today, they lock him up today, tomorrow is out. It's just a serious problem, and yet we argue here on our side that these guys should in fact get paid. Why must he sit there? But South Africa, society outside says, no, the police picked him up yesterday, tomorrow we see him back in the street. They don't understand this thing that, look, this man just stole a chicken. And really, it costs more to keep him inside than to have him. For them, if you stole my chicken, he must go and get arrested forever and stay there forever. So Those are the, I mean, that's the stark reality, the hard questions that, ISS and others are saying to us. Go and change the budget, and the way to change it is to cut some of the idealistic services that you have, ask them to give people more bail, get people that are serving less than 24 months out, and all those things will address correctional services challenges. It doesn't address society's challenges. When I say it probably does in the long term, but the knee-jerk reaction would be an outcry. If we did any of those things, gave him parole, gave him bail, said anybody that's less than 24 months mustn't go, any of those things, I can tell you the knee-jerk reaction would be that this government is not serious about crime. And how then do we address that, including the fact that if we give Vincent, who's been there, a guaranteed job outside, and somebody who has got a degree, has been unemployed for 6 months, it's all those complications that we will have to, I'm sure when we argue the department, they'll throw those at us, and we'll have to be able to say, but no, this is what we do. So those are the type of things that are coming out there, and maybe there should be an Indaba Mamgwenya. Yeah, I really agree with you. Maybe we should have an Indaba and say, this white paper, when they conceptualized it, and the reality that we have today, do we still stick by it or do we change it? Because I don't think there's any law that should be, crafted in stone, even if it's costing us money or not bearing any fruit. Because it's 16 or 18 billion rand that we could take and use somewhere else. But we're using it because the white paper says we must do it, and we know that Vincent goes in and out every year. I think it's irresponsible of all of us if we continue to do that. So those are the questions. Maybe we need to have this endowment. And the next time the department does its threat plan, maybe your initial part of your threat plan would have to be a civil society endowment. Doing your threat plan in isolation, that side, you don't understand what the other people are saying. So I'm saying these are the type of things that I think we should be, all of us, advocating to the minister and everybody else. I know I was at a stakeholder meeting last week or the week before, and I know that they've said that they want to, and there were people from NICRO, they asked the people from Gauteng, they would tell you. They want to re-look at the strat plan, so maybe it's a good opportunity now for us to say, before you even look at it, let's broaden the stakeholder and have this type of meeting where there's no holds barred and come back. But I think that's where we need to go to. But I did note that there was a few Makakul that wanted to say something, and thereafter you would have an opportunity to respond, and maybe we can go, oh, let's take Makakul and Paul, and then the presenters will respond, and then maybe we try and argue Mamgwenya's point on the 1st and on the 8th of June, Mom, when the department is here and the committee is here, on the basis of what has come out today. Is that okay? So, Makakula, Paul, and then you'd respond, and then we will interact with the department on the 1st and on the 8th of June. Baba, Makakula.
When are you there? I think first we have to know where we are as a South Africa. We are the developmental state. We still need a lot of resources. We care about the people that are living in this country. But there are a lot of things that are happening in this very same South Africa. The budget that we had is not enough always. And that shows that we are busy developing. This is a very good idea, a very good ideology, because we have to, at the end of the day, to go there. But at this present juncture, we don't have enough. We still have the problem of the unemployment. The people that didn't go to prison the problem is there. Many people are unemployed. And now us, we want to take the offenders up now. Indeed. But because we had to understand where we are a developmental state. Which give us this thing that we can go to university, all of us. Lucky you'll be employed, and I'll be not employed. The things that we had to do in our institution is to train offenders. It's what we're supposed to do. Train offenders with the willing that they're going to work when they go outside. But because we are a developmental state, we can't be responsible of any life of the person of the person while he's out of prison. We can't be charged, we can't be responsible for anything that he do. Our work is to rehabilitate, is to correct. And meanwhile is still there. We allow them to train so that when they go outside, they face the life there. I'm really shocked, Chair, if the offender said, no, extend my parole. It gives us no way. But in the end of the day, what we can do? Nothing. When a developmental state, we didn't reach that kind of life where you'll be trained even in prison and taken care of when you go outside. Remember, the president was speaking about the unemployment, job creation. We still have a lot of people who are not working outside. And in the end of the day, if we cannot allow that people will have to do something so that they know that if I can go to prison, things will be simple. But actually, we can do everything, everything in our life, in our heart, in our power, as a government, to make sure that no matter you are in prison, you are the human being. You are rehabilitated. Actually, some of the things, Chairperson, it comes, goes beyond. We feel it, but it comes, goes beyond. We're a developmental state. We still have a lot of problems outside there. So it can't just be solved. Indeed, as you make research, as you do a lot of things, as you check, keep on doing that. It also assists in us. But some other things, it can be fund all of it. We look step by step or bit by bit, how can we go to correct this offender? I think.
Just going back to what I raised earlier on and what Honorable Ngwenya spoke about, particularly around the challenge ex-offenders face in terms of unemployment, I think the answer to this would lie mostly on what the minister has recently announced. I think it was in her budget vote speech that there are currently talks around the issue of the criminal record to say that maybe we need to start looking at addressing the issue of criminal record. Maybe perhaps we need to get more information, more development around that particular issue as to how far is the minister or the justice cluster around this particular issue, so that when we move forward, we'll be knowing that whether this will assist or not. But Second, I'm convinced that what you are proposing, that there should be centers of expertise, should really be placed at particularly your minimum security facilities. Like you said, we need our target focus should be those who are 35 years and less. And logic would tell you that that would could perhaps be best placed at minimum security facilities. And in doing that, I think we could try to alleviate to a certain extent the impact overcrowding has on inmates. This could be done by ensuring that more, if not all, offenders in those institutions go out and work, or go out and attend education programs. Then the cells could be used only for sleeping purposes. That's what the inspecting judge has been advocating. And residents have been looking at development in the states of New York to say that when the prison system started there, particularly at the urban prison facility, the authorities believe that the state could not provide shelter, accommodation, clothing, and so on and so forth to offenders. But then our offenders need to go out and work so that the facility could become self-sufficient. I think that could also be applied here, particularly in those facilities. And in a way, because in most cases, when you talk about offender labor, we've heard DCS, on the other hand, responding by saying, we cannot take all offenders out, you know, because of security concerns and so on and so forth. But then now in those facilities, because those are minimum security facilities, so there's no problem in terms of security and so on and so forth. I think DCS can manage, you know, to say that all offenders could go out and work, and at the same time it means now these facilities are becoming self-sufficient. At the same time, this means these facilities will be alleviated in terms of the impact of overcrowding, particularly in those facilities where we focus our centers of expertise, which would be our minimum security facilities. Thanks, Chair President.
Yes,
the
time is
just to answer the public education campaigns and rural areas, I can just answer for NICRO. We do engage with the public. We particularly ran a big campaign now around alternative sentencing, non-custodial sentencing, and we went into communities, rural and those in the urban areas, and we engage with the public around imprisonment, around creating alternatives. And it was an important engagement because we painted the reality of imprisonment currently, the overcrowding situation, the inhumane detention at some point, the sexual violence, the assault, the gangs. And we also looked at the most important thing is public safety. And as correctional services, that is supposed to be our mandate. When people return to society, it should make sure that society is safe. So we looked at all those consequences, and then we looked at, okay, if people under certain circumstances and for less dangerous offenses were to do community-based sentences, would that be better? They'd remove the harmful effect of imprisonment. And we found generally, and we have the study to prove that obviously they were more in favor of alternatives, provided with the information that if you look at the two scenarios, which one is a better benefit? So you're right, we do agree. Education is critical, and yes, the public is angry because victimization and crime is high. There's lots of emotions, and we do not acknowledge the emotion and how people feel, because they have the right to feel that way. Without doing that, we now look at, okay, now let's look practically at what can be done to make our society safer. So we are doing extensive work, and I'm sure there are other organizations doing that, which is very critical. And we are targeting rural areas as well. To address the unemployment issue, I think that is
very critical, and the whole issue of the challenges we face in our society. And that's right, we're not going to get value for money if we're going to scale people and then they're not going to be employed and then they're going to come back to prison. It just doesn't make sense. I do know one civil society organization and a few others on the outside, but we're doing, because we struggle with the same thing. Ex-offenders come into society, we can't place them or whatever else. But there have been some positives where we do actual lobbying with employers or companies or whatever. And I think it was realistic, one of the organizations, that they secured a contract with a construction agency. And maybe the flip side around is to secure contracts or like the DCS. If you're going to scale so many people, you would secure a contract with a construction company, for instance, that would employ people when released and then work towards skilling those people so that they can be employed. I don't know how realistic it would be, but they also, with the national budget, every single government department is supposed to now create opportunities for job creation. It's an opportunity, once again, to look at, let's rather see what can be secured. But we know formal employment is not the only option. There's self-employment, and that's where we skill people. And many offenders do use plumbing and whatever to be self-employed. But not everybody can run their own business is another thing. So we have to look at that. And I think one needs to really be creative. Also, when you come out, employment, yes, you need money, but also you want to be a constructive citizen. Look, ex-offenders with those skills can also volunteer. And who knows, maybe that would build relationship, build trust, and maybe the employer would employ them. So I think we're going to have to be creative and true, not just set up these centers of excellence without thinking creatively around the outside. And we have to think about what happens on the outside, because it is going to become your problem again if they come back. So your aim is to not get them to come back. I mean, just to just raise the issue, I just started thinking about, if we look at why people go back into the life of crime, and you gave an example as well, and I'm thinking of the offenders that we work with. The main thing is they struggle, yes, with employment, but relationships, family relationships, they don't have social support. They struggle with the effects of imprisonment. So these things can still be done on the outside. It's not just, I just don't want us to isolate the issue of employment. I think that's the end all and the be all. When offenders come out, they are alone, and that's when they start joining the negative company, because they don't get the support they need from their family, understandably so. So the importance to build those relationships is one. That's why Nicola constantly reiterated. I mean, from 1910, that has been our goal. Offenders who are in prison cannot be isolated from their families, because when they come on the outside, that's the support they're going to need that prevents them from going back. So that's critical, and those relationships, also community relationships, the whole power of restorative justice. We haven't even unpacked it in this country properly as to how it can be used and changing it to a restorative, because communities, it's engaging with communities to accept offenders back into society. There's so many wonderful models out there that have been run in other parts of the world that could work here and that are working here if we look narrow enough. So, and restorative approaches, they address individuals' personal restoration, they address family connections, they address community and victims, and I think we cannot ignore that that's a key part of why a person, you know, of rehabilitation. So, yeah, I don't know if I answered all the questions. And just think, when I think of our offenders, what they're struggling with, they've got all their skills development and their papers and what they've been through, but they struggle with basic things like budgeting, basic things like life and social skills. They struggle to socially, properly engage with people. As a result of institutionalization, they've been taking away the power to make decisions for so many years. They don't know how to make decisions anymore. They are angry when you tell them what to do, because they are free now and they shouldn't be told what to do. These are basic things that people struggle with, and things that we can easily incorporate when we're doing skills development, when we're working with people, when we're engaging with people in a correctional facility. So I once presented that we can create a correctional environment that's restorative. And so it does require radically thinking or changing around how we treat people, because if we don't model it, I've always said they're going to. Yeah. So there's an massive opportunity for us to change the way people behave, and we don't have to only do it through sophisticated rehabilitation programs, but we can see how we can use them all.
Thank you very much to ISS and everybody that was involved in that. I wonder if I could make one request jointly between yourselves and Mpho. You know, the recommendations on your last page, I think should be the beginning, Mpho, of some basic document that we would require, really basic. We could do more as we go on, but I do think we need to now put it directly to the department and the minister. I mean, I'm just writing, the heading of this thing has to be, are the goals or the ideals of the white paper achievable? I mean, that is where we start, and taking your recommendations that are there. I'm saying, are they achievable? Employer, bearing in mind that there are budget constraints and that's not going to change. Employee numbers are not going to change drastically. Offender numbers are not going to change positively. In other words, they're not good. Those things in mind are the ideals of the white paper achievable. And if we can just expand and elaborate on those that you have there for us. I mean, you've heard the pros and the cons. We support that those less than 24 months should ideally not go in, but these are the things that we need to address. The knee-jerk reaction from society and so on. The minimum sentence, we agree that is going to reduce it, but how do we address the outcry type of thing? Whether offering rehabilitation is the way to go, I mean the third bullet point. And I think what we are saying here is that whilst we don't want to stop rehabilitation, but maybe reskilling and those things are probably adding more value than just the historic rehabilitation as we've been doing it up to now, and the pros and cons or even the idea that there should be a balance for those that are serving less than 5 years or whatever the figure is. And I think we need to put concrete on the table and say to the minister, this is what the committee is suggesting. Come and tell us why not. The open prison thing, I think the minister is agreeing to that because she talks about halfway houses type of thing. I think the open prison and halfway houses are more or less the same thing. And for a bit more elaboration from their side on that type of thing. And that might have helped this young man that is asking for his stay parole to be extended. If there was a halfway house, it wouldn't have been an issue in his life. So if we could talk to those type of things. And then, of course, the post-release support. Whilst we agree with it, Vanessa is saying that it can't just be DCS, the family must be involved and so on, but then take Makakula's issues as well, that post-release must also bear in mind the knee-jerk reaction from graduates that will be saying, do I have to be arrested and go to jail to be guaranteed support? What about me that have a degree, might not have parents, and I have absolutely no support? So if we could just take just those six things and just very basically explain them. I really want to put it to the minister, even if it means we must give it to them a week before, so that when they come and talk to us, they must start either agreeing to or discarding these recommendations. Otherwise, then, Chandra, your exercise will have just been an academic exercise. We'll try and get it to the minister with our views and to the department and say, when you come back, respond to our initial views. And let's have a real debate when we see the minister and the department. So, Mpho, between you and I know that Cindy leaves us shortly, but we really want a basic thing. I mean, this we will continue to keep because it gives us a basis, but real basic things that says, having considered this, the committee has flagged these things. And we'd ask the department to give us a response. And if they want more detail later on, we can go back and commission you guys to give us the detail it needs to be. But I think we need to put something on the table and get people to agree or disagree in principle on that one. So that would be our request. We meet on the 1st of June. If we could get something to give to the department, Cindy, a week before the 1st of June, just to say to them, when you come to us, these are the type of questions that we would need to answer. And also, I'm hoping that the department has got at least the presentation. If you've got at least the presentation, and look at those recommendations and give us the department's initial views on those recommendations. Thank you very much. Hope everybody has a peaceful Easter, everybody has a successful election, and we meet again, Cindy, on the 25th of May. is our first interaction as a committee. But in between.